Criminal Law and Procedure Committee, Tuesday, March 2nd, 1971, 1 p.m., Room 315, State Capitol. Today's agenda, Senate Bill 40, Articles 14, 15, and 16.
Clerk will check the roll.
Glad Project Director, Criminal Law Division Commission. Starting today with offense against property that began on page 51 of Senate Bill 40, appears on page 130 of the final draft in the court. The next 13 or 14 sections of the code relate to what we term a consolidated theft article. It is somewhat similar in concept to a bill that was prepared in the 1959-61 Interim Committee on Criminal Law, in which they attempted to abolish the technical distinctions between plain old run-of-the-mill larceny and obtaining under false pretenses and embezzlement, and look upon it as all a form of theft. We have taken that same concept and expanded it somewhat to include some other things, such as theft by receiving, theft by embezzlement, theft by deception. And as you go through, you'll see the way we've characterized the fundamental offense of theft. Now, in section 121, we have five definitions that are important in this article. Define some terms such as appropriate and deprive, both of which are really basic to a definition of the requisite intent that's necessary on the part of the thief to exert permanent or virtually permanent control over the property of another, or to behave with respect to property in such a way as to virtually deprive the owner of the value of the property. We, in defining a chain, we define it in such a way that the old concept of an asportation or carrying away the property, which has been traditional in the concept of larceny, is no longer required. Our definition of property itself is an extremely broad one. We attempt to include not only what one would normally think of as property, the tangible kind of goods, but also intangible property, evidence of debt or contract, checks, interest in property, and this sort of thing. We have one particular Oregon case in mind in formulating this definition, and that was the Tauscher case, the 1961 case. It had a very peculiar result in an embezzlement, as much as embezzlement is under present law punishable as larceny. And here you had an agent who was without authority, and for own purposes drew a check on the principal's account. The prosecutor found himself unable to prove either the crime of embezzlement or the crime of larceny. We think we make some needed changes in the law here, in as much as the prosecutor won't find himself out of court because one theory of the crime and his evidence shows something else. We provide under section 122 the procedural consequences of the consolidated theft offense, and we say in effect that a charge of theft is sufficient without designating the particular theory of the crime, except for the crime of theft by extortion. And we deal with theft by extortion separately, in as much as it is classified under the code because of the threat element involved as a more serious offense. The rest of the theft offenses are characterized as Class C felonies, which would be punishable by a maximum of 5 years imprisonment, but with theft by extortion, it's punishable as a Class B felony or a 10-year offense. But we say that you, except for the charge of theft by extortion, you can plead just theft, in the value of the property, who the owner was, and whatever theory of theft turns out to be, whether it's what we normally think of now as obtaining under false pretenses, or a larceny by trick, or embezzlement, or receiving and concealing, it is still, under our definition of crime, theft. Now, under Section 123, it's really the basic definition of theft, which incorporates, then, by reference, the definitions that are set out in Section 121. And we set out five different ways of committing theft under Sub 1, which would be the traditional kind of theft, taking, appropriating, obtaining, or withholding property of another. Or 2 is a theft of lost or mislaid property. 3, theft by extortion. 4, theft by deception. And 5, theft by receiving. And then, of course, in subsequent sections, then we set out the elements of those particular varieties of theft. Now, the primary purpose, of course, of these sections that I've just gone over is to eliminate the traditionally distinct crimes of larceny, larceny by trick, embezzlement, obtaining property by false pretenses, receiving stolen property, and extortion, and to consolidate them into one charge called theft. We try to stay away from artificial distinctions based upon the kind of property involved or the locus of the crime, and the only dividing line that we retain, other again than the extortion kind of theft, is based on the value of the property. Now, sections 124 and 125 deal with 2 degrees, theft in the second degree, theft in the third degree. The dividing line was kept at $250. This admittedly is a somewhat arbitrary figure. I mean, looking at what some of the other states have done, a general upgrading on the dividing line. The difference between a misdemeanor larceny and a felony larceny is $75. The commission generally felt that there should be an upgrading, and that $75 is too low. We're talking about the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. Here again, the commission recognized that reasonable people can differ on this amount. It's somewhat like trying to decide what the age of a minor should be for certain purposes. But in any event, this seemed to be a fairly common amount that was used in some of the new revisions. Some of them have gone even higher. And so it was settled on $250. Now, Section 126 is it's new from the standpoint of a new kind of crime in the theft area. And here you have an individual who either, if he comes into control of property, maybe he didn't steal it originally, he comes into control and he either knows or has good reason to know that it was either lost or mislaid or it was delivered to him by mistake. And maybe when he received it, he had no larcenous intent, but after he came into control of the property, formed larcenous intent, and failed then to take reasonable measures to restore the property to its rightful owner, this person would be guilty of theft just the same as if he had originally taken the property unlawfully himself. Section 127, as I said, is the only Class B felony in the theft area. Distinguished, we should note, there are two things we ought to note. We already talked about the crime of coercion, which is located in the article on kidnapping. The same kinds of threats are involved here. You're trying to coerce somebody either by threat to injure them or some third person or do some damage to property or to accuse them of a crime or some other damaging charge against him with the intent to extort property from him. This differs from extortion or from the coercion statute in that there you have no intent to obtain property from him. The crime should also be distinguished from the crime of robbery, because here we're talking about a threat to do something in the future rather than deception.
Could you elaborate a little bit on FTO? What did you do
with it? Right, well, this would be a... We tried to write in an exception to the collective bargaining kind of theft, or the collective bargaining kind of threat. But here, this would be strictly for the purpose of intimidating, say, a store owner or a company to give up property with the idea that you're going to cause them difficulty either through a boycott or a strike or some collective action. But we were careful, as the other states have been, careful to point out that we're not talking about conduct where you have an agent bargaining on behalf of a bona fide labor group, that sort of thing. This would be a form of what you normally think of as the business blackmail. We have on page 128, we go into that in somewhat more detail with respect to F, as we say, it's aimed at racketeering, but are not intended to jeopardize the collective bargaining process. But the group representative, were bargaining on the basis of getting a kickback from, say, an employer, would be violating this section. Section 128, F by deception. Here we're dealing with the fraudulent kinds of crimes, obtaining under false pretenses, this sort of thing. We eliminate the distinction between law and fact. Traditional restriction now is that it has to be a misrepresentation as to an existing fact. We broaden that to say that he creates or confirms another's false impression of law, value, intention, or other state of mind, which is intended to include not only the misrepresentation of present fact, but it could be future fact, or it could be right of possession. basically common law principles, codification. There are no statutes dealing with this now, but it's a deals with rights of possession. And the first one, persons obtain property by theft or other illegal means shall be deemed to have a right of possession superior to that of the later lease, which is existing law. Joint or common owner shall not be deemed to have a right of possession superior to that of any other joint or common owner. It means you can't steal from the other joint owner. And then Section 3 deals with chattels, where you would have maybe possession of one, but a some other interest in a in another party, security interest of some sort in the property. We have some new provisions dealing with establishing the value, which would be important. We set out three criteria for establishing value, which are somewhat similar to what we have now. But we expanded and tried to make it a little clearer as to how you would establish value, particularly with respect to an evidence of debt, a check or a promissory note, what the value of such an item that were stolen would be based on. We have some defenses under Section 132 that we feel, although these are taken and based on case law, they restate existing law, and it really goes to the question of criminal intent. You have an honest claim of right, that you are unaware of the property was that of another person, or that you reasonably believe you had a right to dispose of the property or act with it in the manner in which you did. Under subsection 2 of Section 132, we have language that's very similar to the defense in our section on coercion. Under 3, if the defense of the defendant receives, retains, and still disposes of property with the intent of restoring it to the owner. Here again, it's just a question of trying to cover all the possibilities that might arise. And the question came up that that you might have a situation where you had an insurance company or some other innocent party that didn't, in fact, come in possession of stolen property, but their intent was not to deprive the owner, but to try to restore it to the rightful owner. Now, under 4, it's somewhat new law in that we say if the defense of the property involved was that of the defendant's spouse, unless the parties were not living together as man and wife and were living in separate abodes at the time of the alleged theft. The commission felt that the criminal law, as we did in other areas of the code, attempt to refrain from getting involved in domestic squabbles. At the same time, they felt here that this was a reasonable approach. It would lead most of your property disputes to the civil courts, divorce courts, but at the same time, we had parties living apart and there had been separation of the property that you should have some criminal sanctions to protect the person who was in rightful possession of property.
That isn't really clear. There ought to be something in there relating the property to that separate abode. The mere fact that they're living apart shouldn't say that the woman leaves the husband and goes and rents an apartment, and then there's a bunch of furniture at home, he takes back some of that that may have been identified as hers herself, but it was still in the original abode. Shouldn't it be necessary that the property, the subject of the theft, be in that separate abode?
Yeah, the assumption was the property would be with whoever was entitled to have it. That's right.
Well, I think it ought to be clarified, because it's much broader than that. It would allow theft. Just when she moves out, then she could charge him with theft of anything, regardless of where it went.
Of course, you could have a property division where there was rights of one spouse and property that was still physically located with another spouse, but he wouldn't have any right necessarily to dispose of it. broad as it is. This followed the lead of some of the other states, the model penal code, in trying to have a separate section dealing with theft of services. And we have a definition of services that includes, but is not limited to, labor, professional services, toll facilities, transportation, telephone or other communication service, entertainment, supplying of food, lodging, or other accommodations in hotels, restaurants, or elsewhere, the supplying of equipment for use, and the supplying of commodities of a public utility nature, such as gas, electricity, steam, and water. Where you do have an unlawful appropriation of these services, and that even though they might not technically amount to property, that someone is nonetheless out monetarily because of the unlawful act of another. Section 134 then is the last section in the consolidated theft article. Covers the joyriding or taking and using of a vehicle without consent of the owner, or you may not have an intent to permanently deprive, but nonetheless you misappropriate the property of another, in this case in the form of a vehicle. It is not limited to motor vehicles, and the Commission specifically intended it not to be limited to motor vehicles, and it could include such things as sailboats and other types of items that might be a vehicle for some purposes but might not necessarily be motorized. Under sub C, you have, first under B, you have a bailment situation where you use or operate the vehicle without the consent of the owner for purpose in a manner, as we say, constituting a gross deviation from the agreed purpose that you might have it for, whether it's you might have it to work on it as a mechanic or repair it for some purpose, didn't have any use to use it in the manner you did to drive to Doris, California or someplace. Sub 3 is very similar, although much less technical and complicated than the existing larceny by Bailey. And those are just very generally purposed and the kind of coverage that we have in the theft article. We think that if generally the effect would be a good one, and that is that an individual who steals property should not escape prosecution merely on the technicality, and that particularly in some of the more sophisticated kinds of theft by deception, you have theories of crimes that are very difficult to prove sometimes, that perhaps you come in on an embezzlement theory and you find out that it's really a forgery or something like that. Although we do have some separate sections dealing with forgery, these are intended to simplify and to get at the evil you're trying to get at, and that is, did you really steal property of another, and not so much how you did it, but what the ultimate effect was.
And section 1.6, why didn't we pass something last time that if you received unsolicited goods through the mail, like a bunch of law books or something, would they be covered then? If you get a bunch of law books through the mail, would you then have to do something about it?
Here we require an intent to deprive the owner of it. Also, you need to show that it was delivered by mistake.
I think, Betty, this is just what we were talking about. I remember we fussed about where you get a delivery of a suit of clothes and you know it's not yours. In other words, the law book is the blind mail situation. The other one is the mislaid property. And I think this does, I think your point's well taken, but the intent of this is to dovetail with that. And so that if you still get the law books issued in order, they were not delivered under a mistake as the nature of the amount of the property or the identity of the recipient.
That final section
fails
to take reasonable measures to restore the property.
I don't think so, unless there is a mistake of the nature of the amount of the property, the identity of the recipient.
If they sent it to you, Senator Brown, and it was, and you received it and it was intended for Senator Durnstead, then I think you might violate this section. If knowing that, then you failed to return it to the rightful owner. But if they sent it to Senator Brown, even though you hadn't ordered it, that's who they intended to get it. And I don't think you get into a criminal situation because the person that they meant to send it to got it. Whether you get into some contractual obligation, it would be a separate, much enforced. But the purpose of the violation of criminal statute, I don't think that the necessary elements would be present.
Okay. Which section is involved?
1.6.
Distinguished lawyer, but I would appreciate his patience in explaining what the various sections of the code meant to me, if other ones were interested. In my experience here at the Oregon Legislature, this is probably the most massive undertaking I have seen, and I think the quality of the work is very high. Our testimony today goes to Article 14, and primarily to one particular type of theft, and that is the theft by shoplifting. We generally agree with the code in transferring specific crime of shoplifting, covering it under the general crime of theft. The existing sections of the law have been rendered somewhat meaningless, and as far as I've been able to learn, most of the prosecution is under the larceny statute. I have with me today two experts, experts in the sense that they deal with this particular type of theft. And I would like to present to the committee at this time Mr. John Chrisman, who is the security officer for the Art of Mayfair stores. And with him is Mr. Richard DeHaan, who is the security officer for the Fred Meyer Company. Mr. Chrisman will make the testimony to the committee, and we do have some amendments which he will present for your consideration. And I can say that the amendments which he will present have been reviewed by our retail council and generally meet the approval of our council. So at this time, with the committee's approval, I'd like Mr. Chrisman to make a statement.
Mr. Carson, first.
Lou, I have a question first. Is the ORC or any Oregon businesses saying and study making any attempt to prevent shoplifting rather than punish the kids and the elderly and kleptomaniacs once they commit the crime? What's going on in the area of opening up counters, making counters lower, encouraging people not to shoplift rather than hitting them on the head once they shoplift?
Well, since we've attempted within our resources to do something in this direction, we've discussed possibly from particular importance to the street job. So far, we haven't got the problem off the ground. You know, this is a problem nationwide. I got this with me. This is a community program for reduced shoplifting, which takes the approach to suggest rather than to try to pop them on the head or hang in the store. And certainly, we feel that education is an important part of our program. But nevertheless, even with education, we still have to have an effective law to
work on. My point, Mr. Chairman, my point is really, certainly it's getting apprehended. It's really what I think we ought to be looking for, in my judgment. I'm not so sure a 12-year-old child or a 65-year-old lady or whoever, and I realize they're not necessarily your greatest problem. You're talking about what experts will do, and I'm sure your witnesses will point that out. But we sweep them all up in the same bag. We sweep up the kid that's stealing a lipstick, and we sweep up the elderly people we're seeing candy, as a matter of fact, as a hot item and things. And I was wondering if any study has been done in the area of, you know, preventing it rather than the other end of it. And
to the extent that the program that talks about it, and this program here has been developed with the American Retail Federation, and it's dangerous. We partner to actually go into communities and stuff and meet with business and old cars and tend to do something. Whether it's a proper program in schools, I'm not able to say. We have discussed particularly
important. Did you say it was being taught in schools?
No. They have one sequence, about 45 minutes that they all in the court of schools. Put it not on shoplifting, but as an inherent to shoplifting, to try to explain to the students some of the consequences of shoplifting. It is serious, and it affects everybody because it increases the effect that it may have on them in later life if they are caught and convicted. They do have this now and then, but we're trying to work with them in development of a more effective program.
Call Mr. Chrisman.
John Christman. I'm the security manager for Arden Mayfair for the state of Oregon. Arden Mayfair operates 31 supermarkets in the state. With respect to your article on theft, shoplifting, which will now fall under the theft statute, is probably a larger problem than most people realize. They think of it mostly as a penny-ante sort of thing. However, the U.S. News & World Report, in their issue of October 26th of last year, indicated that nationally, over $500 million a year is lost to shoplifters, and over $1.5 billion to employee theft and embezzlement. The Supermarket News, which is a trade publication, in its issue of September 21st last year, indicated that 1 in 10 customers, based upon surveys that they had conducted, is a shoplifter. And the losses to retail industry approximates 3% of sales.
What would the breakdown between the general public and employees and the shopping theft?
Employee theft is probably all employee theft, three times that of shoplifting. $1.5 billion from employee-related theft, and $500 million from shoplifting. The Small Business Administration recognizes the problem of shoplifting and publishes a Small Marketer's Aid number 129, which is directed towards instructing the owners of small businesses how to reduce shoplifting. Another article in U.S. News & World Report from March 2, 1970 indicates that shoplifting has increased three times in the last decade, from 1959 to 1969, and it's an ever-growing problem. Someone here indicated that the grandmother and the juveniles are all kind of categorized together with the professionals. This is not necessarily true in every case. We tend to treat each shoplifter that's apprehended on an individual basis, and not all of them are arrested. Many of them, depending upon the circumstances surrounding the theft, are in fact released by the store personnel with no more than a warning or something of that nature. We figure that if one carton of cigarettes per day is stolen from each one of our stores in the state of Oregon, one carton a day per store, our annual loss is $28,000. We know we're losing more than that. Now, because our business, the grocery business, is a low percentage of profit business, last year it averaged nationally 1.2% net profit. This would mean that we would have to sell $2,800,000 worth of groceries simply to replace that loss of one carton of cigarettes per day per store. We would like to see, not necessarily an amendment to, but some additions to the present theft statute. And I have with me here some copies of the language that we would like to see, and I'll give you the rationale behind these suggested changes. We basically do not propose any change to the Section 125, theft in the first degree, but we would like to see an addition to it. As you can see by the handout, we would like to suggest the addition of these sections. Section C, which says that where property is taken by a servant, agent, or employee from his principal or employer and aggregates $250 or more in any 12 consecutive month period, that the theft then becomes a felony type offense. The reason for this is that we have numerous cases of employee theft which occur in dribbles and drabs, but over a period of time until they're apprehended, total large amounts of money. And this would make that type of an offense a felony rather than a misdemeanor. I cite one example of an office girl who, by manipulation of the book, was able to steal $15,000 before we discovered what was going on. However, no theft, any single incident of theft, was larger than $100 at any one time. This would permit that type of an offense to be handled as a felony rather than a misdemeanor. We would also like to see a provision D, which basically says that if an individual has a prior conviction for a misdemeanor theft, that a second offense would be handled as a felony. And our rationale for this is our experience in shoplifting cases. I have with me here a case which we closed up recently in Eugene. Where a woman was sent to the state penitentiary for 4 years for shoplifting. Now, at first blush, this might seem to be an unusually cruel penalty, and hard penalty for a shoplifting violator. However, this woman, with several accomplices, was making a business of shoplifting and was handling from $4,000 to $6,000 a month in stolen merchandise, primarily meat, cigarettes, and clothing. This, some 20 pages, is the official police report on this case. Under the law as it is proposed, without the change D, since none of these thefts involved more than $250 on one occasion, this woman would have had to be tried as a misdemeanor with a maximum 1 year sentence. I might also point out that the same woman had several previous shoplifting convictions and two charges pending against her at the time this activity was going on and when she was apprehended on the final one, where we presented this information to the court and they saw fit to sentence her under the felony provisions of larceny from a building as they now exist. So for this reason, in the case of shoplifters, and for the incidents that I pointed out in the case of employees, we would very much like to see Article 125 amended as basically the piece of paper that I feel you indicate.
Any questions?
Mr. Crispin, are you able to apprehend three times the problem with the employees of your store? Are you? I ask Lou about what you're doing about the public. What's going on to apprehend employees who are sitting three times as much as the public?
All right, let me back up for just a minute. We are attempting to educate the public to the problem of shoplifting and the penalties attached to it. We support public service full-page ads in the paper indicating shoplifting is a crime. We display these full-page tear sheets in our stores. We have signs, decals, closed-circuit television, and things of this sort in an effort to deter the public from stealing. Let's face it, we would much sooner deter a shoplifter than have to apprehend them, because we never come out ahead of the game in either event when we have to apprehend them. It costs us money in sending our people to court to testify and things of this sort. We'd sooner prevent the crime than have to apprehend the shoplifter. But we've been unsuccessful in getting this message across because some people just like to steal. For one reason or another, and I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't tell you what the motivation is in all cases. Now, as far as employees are concerned, we do not apprehend three times as many employees stealing as public. Or probably the simple reason that mathematically, we have many more customers in our stores with an opportunity to steal than we have employees. However, we do find that the amount stolen by employees is larger per incident because they have more access to larger amounts of money and merchandise. They can move either out the back door or by other means larger quantities on a given occasion than a shoplifter can carry out. As far as our prevention program for employees is concerned, we have published notices on all employee bulletin boards by the time clock that our company does not permit this type of activity. It will result in termination and prosecution if it's possible. than a shoplifter can carry out. As far as our prevention program for employees is concerned, we have published notices on all employee bulletin boards by the time clock that our company does not permit this type of activity. It will result in termination and prosecution if it's possible. We employ security personnel, a full-time security department, which has as its sole responsibility, or one of its sole responsibilities, the prevention, detection, and apprehension of this type of behavior. And we're doing everything that we can to eliminate this problem. We're working with the trade unions, the retail clerks, in having them advise their members at membership meetings the penalties attached to this type of behavior. So we're doing, I think, just all that we reasonably can. We publish articles on this in the company house organ. We're doing, I think, all that can be expected of us to prevent this type of activity, and we have been successful in reducing it. But it's a long process.
Are you reasonably satisfied that you've taken care of, in your experience, the problem I raised, and that is not the one that has the dummy bags and the coats and the professional shoplifter, but the child or the, perhaps the person who becomes senile or difficult? You've satisfied yourself that you've solved most of that problem by what you call an individual basis?
That's right. Our company's policy, because it's been our experience, that the only true deterrent to shoplifting is prosecution. If we release the average shoplifter, he figures, or it's been our experience, that the individual says, well, I got away with it here. I'll either try it again here or I'll try it somewhere else. So we're just kind of shuffling the problem around. Our company policy states that we will prosecute shoplifters as a general rule. However, the exceptions are juveniles, senile people, pregnant women, women who have a large family and who being put in jail would work a hardship both on them and the state, because then the state has to support the kids and all that sort of thing. So we do have these exceptions, and a lot of cases are handled under these exceptions at the store level. We may call the juvenile's parents and ask them to come pick the child up and explain to them what's happened, things of this sort. But there are those that we prosecute as well. And as I say, it's a judgment type of resolution that's made at the store level at the time the individual's apprehended.
Does the union do anything about this as far as their membership concerning after employees caught?
Yes, sure they do. I can't speak with first-hand knowledge because I've never personally attended one of their meetings, but I do know that they advise their people that, you know, if you get caught stealing from your employer, you're going to lose your job and you may go to jail.
Do they have any regulations regarding union membership? Can they lose their membership in the union if they're caught?
No. To my knowledge, there are no provisions for losing union membership because of a confession or admission of theft.
Any other questions, Senator Roy?
How would you prepare your losses from bad checks from the shop?
I hope to have an opportunity tomorrow to discuss that problem with you. It's very difficult to say because we can pinpoint very specifically, almost to the penny, our bad check losses. It's awfully difficult for us to tell what our shoplifting losses are because we don't apprehend everyone that shoplifts from us. The national average, in our experience, has been that we probably apprehend 1 out of 20. We catch 1 out of 20. I would say that our losses from shoplifting probably are equal to our bad check losses.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to talk about bad checks tomorrow? Does that come under a section 128?
Yes, we have bad checks or will be discussed under the forgery article.
It wouldn't come under 128?
No. Bad checks, as I mentioned, are included under theft by deception. That would be a form of committing theft by deception by means of a bad check, but we also have a misdemeanor statute take care of is the lesser amount.
Well, we discuss this then tomorrow. We'll be really covered in both parts of this story.
Yeah, so when we talk about forgery, we'll talk about checks.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Did you want to call your other witness?
I'll bet you have some questions you want to ask. Do you have anything you want to say?
Nothing outside the doors of our firm of the full amendment of this.
Senator Carter.
Lou, do you know of any, in the bird field, is it still not, I think the major problem is stemming from the fact that we've now gone to self-service. The ratio of employees to people seems to have changed, at least kind of for the small part of the problem here, part of the problem. Is there any information in the business about maybe department stores, variety stores, grocery stores, as opposed to other sales stores? One thing about the small appliances, there are a lot more subjects being taken than yard goods. Is there a particular part of the industry, or is it so widespread going clear across paint stores and hardware stores and all that? Would you mind?
No.
I'll be as brief as I can. It's widespread. There's no two ways about it. I'm in charge of security.
You just state your name and the organization.
Richard Dion, Fred Meyer Corporate. And it's widespread. There's no two ways about it. There are certain articles, of course, that are much more acceptable than others, as you say, yard goods and so forth. Oh yes, there have been a few occasions of folks' materials stolen. But in the main, appliances, mostly those type items that can be resold, stolen by professionals, stolen by winos and dope addicts and so forth. And then, of course, the amateur, the housewife type, who steals anything that can add a little bit to or supplement her budget.
What's your store's policy about shoplifting and abuse?
Shoplifting by juveniles, we realize that as part of the community, we have just about as much responsibility to teach right and wrong to the juvenile as does the parent. Every one of our store executives is a parent. And we do everything within our power on the apprehension of juveniles to sit down with them and discuss this act of theirs. First of all, find out why, if we can. And secondly, attempt to show them where the continuation of this particular act is going to lead them. In other words, to...
But does the first act ever lead them down to the county court or juvenile?
Generally, no, but there are exceptions, of course.
If I were a juvenile shopper, I think that'd be the best lesson.
Sometimes, it's just like adults, you can get across to them by sitting down and talking to them. You can get across to them with the point that you want to make, and that is to deter, to prevent the same from occurring again. You can do it with juveniles, you can with adults. And if we honestly believe after talking for a half hour, 45 minutes with a juvenile, that they will not do it again, then we will send them in. In other words, give them a record of the same thing for the rest of their life. We've had pretty good success with this policy. Actually, about a third of 1% of our shoppers are repeat. A third of 1%.
You mean that you want to get that guy or somebody else catch him next time, or you really think he's out of business?
I don't know. Somebody else may catch him next time. He doesn't come back to our stores.
Your stores or that particular store?
Our stores. Any one of ours.
You really know that, do you?
Yes, we've kept since 1933, we've kept records on repeat offenses. It's 131%.
Pretty good record. Any other questions?
Sure. Yes, maybe this is in line with that. What percentage of the shoplifting would you say is by professionals, and what is by amateurs or semi-pros?
Of course, the answer to that would just be my opinion. The professionals in number are fewer than the other type, the amateurs, the dope addicts, and so forth. However, in dollars and cents loss, they perhaps steal more in the total than the rest.
How about dope addicts? Do you have any in this community? What percentage do you think they steal?
behind the professionals, not too far behind the professionals because of their habit.
When you add the professionals and the dope addicts, then what percentage would, I know it's only your estimate, what percentage of the value of stolen goods would you say they steal versus the percentage stolen by the amateur?
Perhaps 50-60% dollar and cent value.
That's the combined.
I'd say 60%.
Any other questions?
Now, those aren't included in your repeaters, or are they? The pros. Do you have much of a history? Of course, after they get a few more times, they don't repeat very long.
Yes and no. But they're included in that.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much. Dick Martin, did you want to... All right. Thank you, Lou.
Mr. Petty, Chairman Dick Martin, Deputy District Attorney Portland, on behalf of the Portland Study Committee. First of all, we like what the committee has done in theft. It makes a lot of sense what you have done. We would suggest some distinctions be made in the following areas. Number one, looting. Number two, receiving and concealing stolen property. And number three, an aggregation concept being added to the code or a change in the dollar amount that is now set in the code. Those three things. Number one, let me talk about looting. We have proposed that looting be inserted into Section 125, theft in the first degree, as an additional subsection with value not considered as part of that crime. For this reason, there are instances of major catastrophe, and as you'll see in our proposed wording of the amendments, we would ask that you do. We have asked that that section include those type of catastrophes where, say, an earthquake or fire or explosion would hurl property out into the street where it was freely accessible to all who might walk along, or other looters may have discarded this property as not being desirable to them. These situations would not qualify as a burglary under our code. We don't feel that, we do feel that such a looter should be punished as a felon and not as a simple misdemeanor if he qualifies under our proposed amendment. And we have lifted the wording you have used in a later section defining this type of catastrophe and asked that it be inserted into the theft section. We feel burglary is fine if we can prove they actually broke and entered a store. We'll take them under burglary. But where they are looting by picking up merchandise that's strewn about in the streets, we feel that they should be punishable under the definition of a Class C felony. Perhaps others would feel that that is not sufficiently strong for a looter. We'll leave that to the committee's judgment. Receiving and concealing stolen property. Yes, before we go on.
Certainly, Senator. I'm looking at your I think it's your draft. Starts on page 52, and you have a substitute language. Theft is committed during a fire, explosion, or crime. That's the wording you're recommending.
Yes.
I appreciate that you looked at that from another part of ours, but we have, if we do adopt this, it isn't the inclusion of such things, crime. Are we getting, is it sort of redundant? In other words, you're saying crime is committed while he's stealing something, taking something while a crime is being committed. And don't you think we can do the same if we, you're really talking about riot, aren't you?
Yes, we are. We were considering this right at the time of the Los Angeles earthquake, and we also thought of the summer riots that Portland incurred where shop windows were smashed, property left littered about the streets. Basically, all you could take a looter for then was petty larceny if you picked up a suit of clothes that was only worth $50, for instance, out of the store. We feel like he should be probably punishable in the discretion of the court as either a felon or a misdemeanor. I agree perhaps crime is redundant and the committee can strike that and still achieve the same purpose.
We have run the old legal bugaboo of once you delineate those things that you're thinking about, fire, explosion, crime, time catastrophe, and in effect you're limiting the other emergency in the area. Are you satisfied if we took out crime, left fire, explosion, catastrophe, aren't we losing the biggest one, the riot one, the truth of civil disorder, or some of the other ones?
We struggled for almost 5 or 6 hard hours trying to come up with a wording for this. And this is what we felt would be the best umbrella concept to cover this area. But we're certainly open to any changes. You think we'll do a better job. It was very difficult to try to anticipate all the situations where it might come up and yet be definite enough to satisfy the constitutional requirements. So we're hoping that those terms would limit the emergency definition sufficiently that you can work with. The police feel that this is essential in times of mass disturbances such as we see across the United States, where you actually can't punish the person for breaking in the store because you didn't see him, but you have caught him carrying a suit of clothes. You should be able to punish him specifically for that. As you know, most of these occur at night, making photographic surveillance very difficult, if not impossible, to later pinpoint who was seen coming out of the window of the store. Now, receiving and concealing stolen property, we would like the committee to consider in this area, in section 129, our proposal that this be a no-value requirement for this good, for the goods in question here, for this reason. There is currently no value requirement for the crime of theft by receiving as it now exists under the law. We like what has been done by the committee in broadening the definition. We would ask that you make it a Class C felony, irrespective of the value of the property, for this reason. We have a large number of professional fences operating in metropolitan Portland, and Lieutenant Warren of the burglary detail, who's going to speak with you on burglary in a minute once we get to that section, is more expert in this area than I. Many times when the police execute a search warrant in a professional fence's home, they will come up with only one or two identifiable items. You know positively, as sure as you're born, that the rest of the property is stolen. Probably every single stick of furniture in the place is stolen. But you can only come up with one item, and that one item might well be a $50 item that an owner can positively identify as having come from a burglar. Now, we're required to show that this thief had more than $250 worth of property in his possession. The deterrent effect of having a potential felony conviction is removed. Another example is we have specialist fences in the city of Portland that deal in nothing but stolen credit cards, period. That's all they have. Maybe 50 or 60 at a time they have on their person. Now, perhaps you could say the definition of what the economic loss is under the value section would be sufficient. We would much rather prefer that a person with one stolen credit card or 10 or 15, if the circumstances convince a jury that he knew it was stolen, be allowed to be punished either in the discretion of the judge as a felon or a misdemeanor. It's very seldom that we have an individual article of property, except maybe color TVs, that are worth more than $250.
Now, the way this is drafted, it doesn't place a value on it, does it?
No, Senator. You have to look back to the first degree, second degree, section 124 and 125. Any of these thefts are punished solely through 124 or 125.
Is receiving?
That by receiving, yes. If you look at 123. Now, we can solve this problem one of two ways. You can lower the dollar value, or, as we would suggest, you adopt a specific statute in the theft and checks area both that allows us to aggregate the sums involved. Either way, the police feel they can live with that. Obviously, if a check faster isn't floating more than $250 worth of checks, they're not that much of a menace to the community. But if they're carefully drawing each check for $249.99, as we've had in the past with real pro check operators under Section 128, they will avoid punishment as a felon under this law. Now, I realize there are other states that have an existing body of case law that says you can use a turnstile theory by aggregating all the amounts of the thefts. Oregon does not. It does not have case authority, nor does it have statutory authority to permit this.
Vic, are you going to propose specific language? We have Mr. Christman has given this a similar.
I was reading the Illinois Criminal Code today. I couldn't find one that really did the job. They use a 90-day aggregation figure. And I think the framers must have looked it over into the Illinois Code. And I frankly don't know which will do the best job for Oregon. I would suggest something in the nature of the Illinois Code, and I will submit that in a written form.
Fine. I want to represent the person accused of receiving. It seems an anomaly to me that the value of the goods was below $75, and yet he was charged with a felony. And I guess the law in Oregon apparently isn't clear. He never had to appeal because he got the sentence tricky. But it is an anomaly that someone who receives something can be put in the penitentiary while the one that steals it is only guilty of a misdemeanor.
And this statute, I would contend, Senator Cook, is really designed for your fence, who is perhaps more dangerous to the community than the thief.
Now, isn't this something, though, that instead of eliminating the dollar value or clearly saying that it doesn't apply, it would be better to do, as Senator Carson suggested, provide for an aggregate crime rather than taking out the dollar equivalent?
Well, either way would to me, appear to be a reasonable solution to the problem. Now, Lieutenant Warren, I think if anybody knows about fences in metropolitan areas, Lieutenant Warren is going to testify about burglary to you. Because they are a major problem. They're the reason for the existence of some of our burglars. Without them, the burglar couldn't exist. And they're tough to get. They're very tough because they're smart. If they weren't smart, they'd be out burglarizing themselves, but they're smart. The real problem, gentlemen, in Section 128, without an aggregation concept, is that I pointed out we've had some very large professional check operations come into the city of Portland. That each member of a five-man gang passed over $5,000 worth of checks over one Labor Day weekend on an account that they themselves created by establishing a deposit for a fictitious business of about $250, got business checks. Each one made up $5,000 worth of volume. Banks were closed past them and got out of the state. Now, if it's only a misdemeanor, you can bet that the prosecutions in these cases will drop to almost zero for your transient check passers that are pros, because most prosecuting attorneys will not extradite on misdemeanors simply because they can't justify the taxpayer expenditure on a simple misdemeanor case. It's only a felony that usually a prosecuting attorney will ask to be extradited. It's only the rare misdemeanor that you bring back. So that's a very practical consideration that I think the committee should consider. Yes, Senator, I will. I'll not take any more of the time on this area.
Thank you.
You bet.
Any other on section Article 14? We'll turn to Article 15.
Article 15, Mr. Chairman,
It was brought to our attention through Lane County District Attorney's Office that possible amendments should be considered with respect to these general definitions, and that inasmuch as they do apply to criminal trespass, and there has been, as we all know, a great amount of difficulty with respect to sit-in kind of situation, particularly university buildings, public buildings, courthouses, state office buildings, this type of thing. And the idea was to try to tighten up the definitions that apply throughout here, not to get at the burglaries, but to get at the trespass. So the subcommittee and the commission that considered this area took testimony from Mr. Leahy and one of his assistants. We took testimony from the Attorney General's office, and we took testimony from individuals representing the University of Oregon alumni, and attempted to restructure these definitions that appear in Section 135, providing more effective means of dealing with trespass. Now, basically, our definition of building is unchanged. The definition of dwelling, which of course is important in the burglary situation, is unchanged. The first change appears with respect to the definition of enter or remain unlawful. And I would like to take the committee's time to go through those in some detail, to set forth the reasons behind these proposed amendments. It's defined, first of all, as meaning to enter or remain in or upon premises when the premises at the time of such entry or remaining are not open to the public, or when the entrant is not otherwise licensed or privileged to do so, or, and then here is an important change, to fail to leave premises that are open to the public after being lawfully directed to do so by the person in charge. Now, admittedly, this is a sensitive area, extremely complicated, and to get into some constitutional grounds of free speech, assembly. At the same time, we're attempting to balance the rights of individuals to be in public places and to make lawful use of premises, particularly public buildings, and at the same time give persons who are in charge of these places some authority to deal with these situations to occur. Then we go on to define what we mean by open to the public. That's defined as meaning premises which by their physical nature, function, custom, usage, notice, or lack thereof, or other circumstances at the time would cause a reasonable person to believe that no permission to enter or remain is required. And then we attempt to define the kind of person who is in charge and who would be able to tell persons that their use of the premises has ceased to become lawful and they are requested to leave. Person in charge is defined as meaning a person, his representative, or his employee who has lawful control of premises by ownership, tenancy, official provision, or other legal relationship.
Well,
I'm on burglary and criminal trespass, and you have amendments that are in your book, at least they should be, in your committee book. As amendments to the bill itself. Amendments to Section 135. These are proposed amendments to final draft dated November
2017.
Don't you have those? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had those in your books.
We don't have them.
Well, my error then. Maxine, we don't have copies of amendments.
No, I don't.
We have them in the books. I'll
come back and find copies
on it. But other than that, you were doing fine.
Yeah, other than that, we could go on.
then go on to the next section talking about burglary. I apologize. These were supposed to have been inserted in your books, in your committee books, so that you can see the amendments that you're talking about here. But I can go on until you get them. We're trying to, first of all, distinguish between a lawful usage of a public building and an unlawful one, and to recognize that people, for example, can come into the Capitol building and use it for some lawful purposes. And, for example, even in the rotunda, some usages of the rotunda might be lawful because of the nature of it. But 50 people in the rotunda would be far different than seeing 50 people coming into this meeting room in the course of a meeting. Sitting down in the middle of the floor, or laying down in the middle of the table, and to avoid these kind of situations, and to put the people on notice, rather than making a mass arrest or an attempt to make a mass arrest, to put them on notice by responsible persons that their usage of the premises has ceased to become lawful, and that they are asked to desist and to leave, or desist from the kinds of activities that they're engaging in. The commission was intending, when we first drafted this, to try to deal with these kind of situations, but the commission, both in subcommittee and the full commission, after hearing the testimony and looking at these amendments, felt that these amendments were worthwhile, and did not only give the people who are charged with the administration of the public building some effective means of dealing with the situation, but also to place persons on notice and give them an opportunity, once they've been told, to remove themselves from the premises without facing arrest. Yeah, where you read the so-called Riot Act, and that's where the terminology comes from, where you tell them, you know, that they are violating the law and that they Well, in a sense we are, but we're not necessarily talking about a riotous situation here. We're talking about a situation which, because of sometimes just the mere force of numbers, where there may not necessarily be an intent to engage in a riot, but it may develop.
This was a riot in this case 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I know, and we heard testimony about that case before the commission, and the district attorney, Benton County, felt that these amendments that were proposed would have been very helpful to him under those circumstances to control that very kind of situation. But Mr. Leahy, who worked on these amendments, the chairman is here. The commission has heard from Mr. Leahy about this, but generally this is the kind of situation these amendments are attempting to get at. And we could go on rather than hold up for those amendments. The definition of building becomes important not only in burglary but also trespass. We've provided for 2 degrees of burglary. In section 136, we have a second degree burglary classified as a Class C felony. And it's defined very simply, a person enters or remains unlawfully in a building with intent to commit a crime therein. It's important to note how this basic definition of burglary differs from existing law. We think we've made some desirable changes here. definition. It requires no breaking. It's consistent with existing law that's found in ORS 164-220. It eliminates the necessity of proving an intent to steal or to commit a felony in the non-dwelling kind of burglary, as is presently required under the statute. And we make the intent element the same as it would be under the dwelling kind of burglary, and that is an intent to commit any crime. Also, the definition of burglary does away with the need for proving the property was kept in the building at the time. So that you can have, in other words, you can have a lawful entry, but it could nonetheless become burglary because of an unlawful remaining that coincided with the intent to commit some crime in that building. Section 137 is an aggravated type of burglary. It incorporates the basic definition of burglary and the classification of the offense, as well as the penalty, making it a Class B felony. And I should mention here that because of the aggravated nature of the crime, that there was a split of authority on the commission as to whether or not this should be graded as a Class A felony rather than a Class B. The argument was made that we have some of the same kinds of aggravating factors here that we have in first-degree robbery, for example, and that because of the threat to persons as well as property, there's a good argument to make of a Class A or a 20-year crime. The majority of the commission, however, voted in favor of a Class B felony. These aggravating factors are that if the building is a dwelling, it becomes first-degree burglary. Or if, even in a non-dwelling kind of building, if an effecting entry into the building, or while in the building, or in immediate flight therefrom, he is either armed with explosives or a deadly weapon. Whether he actually uses them or not is immaterial. If he's armed with them, it becomes first degree. Or if he causes or attempts to cause physical injury to any person, or he uses or threatens to use a dangerous weapon. Under existing law, burglary in a dwelling house, including breaking and entering while armed with a dangerous weapon or assaulting any person therein, is now punishable by a maximum penalty of 15 years as compared to 10 years in a non-dwelling burglary. And neither of the statutes now distinguish between a daytime or a nighttime burglary. So the proposed section then applies the aggravating factors equally to dwellings and non-dwellings, and we would continue to treat daytime and nighttime burglaries alike. We have what we think is a very important law enforcement section, Section 138, a new crime of possession of burglary tools. And this section says that the person violates this section and commits this crime if he possesses any burglary tool with the intent to use the tool or knowing that some other person intends to use it to commit a forcible entry in the premises, which would be a burglary situation, or theft by a physical taking. So the mere fact that we designate this crime as possession of burglary tools is not meant to limit it solely to the kinds of tools that would be used in burglaries, but could also include such items as specialized tools or devices to use to break into parking meters, to break into telephone devices, and this type of thing. We define burglary tools to mean an explosive tool, instrument, or other article adapted, designed, or commonly used for committing or facilitating forcible entry into premises or theft by a physical taking. It's really a form of an inchoate crime, and there was considerable discussion on the commission whether crimes such as possession of burglary tools or possession of unlawful possession of slugs to use in throwing machines should be made separate substantive offenses. The commission wisely, in my opinion, had separate sections dealing with these rather than looking upon them as attempted burglary or attempted theft. Although some argument could be made that it is a substantial step towards the commission of a crime and maybe could constitute an intent. But we feel it's a necessary law enforcement tool, and that although frequently it would be a means to make a lawful arrest, and the chances are the individual arrest can subsequently be indicted and prosecuted for an actual burglary or a form of larceny or theft, that this is a prophylactic standpoint, a necessary type of statute. We've tried to avoid the problem that the city of Portland had with their city ordinance and getting into an unconstitutional problem by prohibiting the possession of items that could be lawful, such as screwdrivers or crowbars or wrenches or things that could be used to commit a theft or burglary. But also that you get too much overkill in the statute and end up with no statute at all. So we do require that you have to show an intent to use the tool or a knowledge on the part of the person possessing the tool that it's going to be used unlawfully.
Chairman, the policeman stops the car and finds these tools in the car. Let's say they're obviously burglary tools. Unless he had some reason to believe an intent, he doesn't take that out of it.
They have probable cause to make an arrest that he felt that there was an intent, and there may be some other knowledge that the policeman might have, such as a recently reported burglary and this type of thing. But it does give you a means, something to hang your hat on. And granted, if it comes to prosecuting under this statute, you're going to have to prove the intent. Otherwise, if you end up to with a statute that's void because it's unconstitutional, but because it would prohibit the lawful possession of certain kinds of tools. Because some kinds of tools, clearly by their very nature, are only burglary tools and they're easily identified. But there are other kinds of tools that are used for burglary, such as picks and crowbars and things such as this, where you would have to show an intent. And by requiring that intent in the statute, we can avoid that kind of constitutional objection to it.
So the intent coming under the very first paragraph of Section 138 would seem to me that the policeman would have to be able to prove intent at the time he took the man to jail, or else the guy just got a plea.
The policeman doesn't have to prove anything. The policeman has to have probable cause to make an arrest, Senator. He doesn't have to try and convict him on the spot. He has to have probable cause based on the information he has. Now, the policeman arresting under such a statute, undoubtedly he would have other suspicious circumstances surrounding the arrest, such as a recently reported burglary in the area, suspicious circumstances that occurred, an automobile fitting the description that has been notified of the police, any number of things. I'm not suggesting that the police are just going to willy-nilly start stopping cars and look for certain kinds of tools and make an arrest, but,
Brett, I'll try from a different angle. I think what Dick's worrying about is the difficult to prove intent from possession of crowbars. But there are ways that the late into the hour, you've caught the warehouse complex at 3 in the morning, and this sort of thing, they've been able to give circumstantial evidence on intent. So it's not easy.
And most intent, whether you're talking about this kind of intent or intent to commit some other kind of crime, I'm sure Mr. Martin would agree with this, most intent is proved, usually unless you have a confession or an admission, is proved by circumstantial evidence. But you need, in order to save the statute from getting thrown out, such as the Portland Municipal Ordinance, kind of trouble they had with their ordinance, where it was so broad that it prohibited lawful possession of certain kinds of tools. You can't make it a crime to possess a screwdriver. But it does give the police something to go on
acts of burglary before they occur.
But the preacher doesn't have the intent to use that before they take the
application. Yes, sir. Probable reason to believe there is an unlawful intent concurrent with the possession. Do we have any amendments now?
Yes, we do.
Now, as I mentioned, the new language appears under sub 3 and sub 4, 5 and 7. That's where your new language is. And I really think I've probably said it all I can, except that they come into play over in the section 139 and 140, where you get into your criminal trespass situation. Because criminal trespass in the second degree is a person commits the crime, criminal trespass in the second degree, if he enters or remains unlawfully in or upon premises. Now, premises, under our definition, includes a building, and it could also include trespass to real property. Because the basic definition of trespass is included. Intended to cover all kinds of trespass to farm property and this kind of thing also. And I might mention here that in defining trespass, we were interested in simplifying the statute and getting an ease of definition and as few elements as possible in the crime rather than the severity of the punishment. I know that based on information I've heard, I know Senator White, the last session legislature, some of the